Good morning. I'd like to open the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection for Tuesday, May 31st, 2011. Committee, we have five bills before us today, this being our last meeting to pass bills out of the committee. So with that, we're going to probably go down the list in the order that they appear. And with that, I'm going to open a possible work session on Senate Bill 382A. Jen, can you remind us what this bill does?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a bill that the committee heard last week, and it involves notices on lien claims. And the committee adopted the -A4 amendment last week. The original A engrossed bill came with no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. The fiscal impact statement is not prepared yet on the A4 amendment.
So with that, we can suspend the rules to move this bill without the fiscal impact statement if everyone at the dais agrees to that. And we can probably go ahead and have a motion to suspend the rules.
Mr. Chair, I move we suspend the rules on and vote on Senate Bill 382.
Representative Wisnett moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of passing out Senate Bill 382 without its fiscal impact analysis. Is there a discussion? Is there any objection? And the rules are suspended. Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 382 to the floor, but do pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 382 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Not seeing any discussion. Mr. Niebel, would you like to come forward and just give us sort of a brief overview of the history of this bill and the work that you've done on it with the amendment and the stakeholders involved?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Niebel from the Oregon State Bar. This is a bill that was put forward by the Oregon State Bar Construction Law Section. It's meant to correct a problem that practitioners were having in giving notice to assinees, basically, in the deed record. It was difficult to ascertain their addresses in many cases, even though they had been required to file their names and addresses in the record back to January 1st, 2008. We worked this bill in the Senate. The Bankers Association came forward with some concerns about retroactivity. We worked with them when the bill came into the House and worked out the set of amendments that you've adopted. The amendments are agreed between the bankers and the proponents, the construction law section. They take out the emergency clause. They make the bill effective as to assinees, retroactive back to the date on which they were first required to place their names and addresses in the record, which was January 1st, 2008. As to regular mortgagees, banks, and so forth, it's effective as of the effective date going forward. This bill only affects Chapter 87, construction liens. It does not have any effect on Chapter 86, which is the general mortgage and trustee statute. And I'd be happy, I understand, as I recall, there was no fiscal impact or minimal fiscal impact when this bill passed the Senate, and I do not believe that these amendments will cause any additional fiscal impact.
All right. Any questions? Mr. Niebel, so just so I'm clear on this bill, so in the case of a construction lien, then that lien has to be recorded, and that the owner then is established
Yes. Mr. Chair, that's correct. They would have to put their name in the deed records in order to be entitled to notice from a construction company who
right.
was perhaps going to assert it.
So what happens if there isn't somebody recorded as the owner? In the case of MERS, I think that was one of the issues that came up around this.
I think that the obligation under this bill on the construction company who's perhaps going to assert a lien would be to give notice to people whose names and addresses are in the record, and I suppose that would be MERS itself. And if no other entities are in the record with their names and addresses, there is no obligation to provide notice.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate you just refreshing our memory of the bill. Committee, we have a motion before us. Any other discussion? Not seeing any. Tamara, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative Flynn.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Excused.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Yes.
Co-Chair Wisdom.
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby.
Aye. Senate Bill 382, having received required votes, is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 382.
Do you want to name a carrier?
Would we like a carrier? Would anybody like to carry this? Yes, I will carry it then. With that, I will open a possible work session on Senate Bill 487. Jan, can you refresh our memory on Senate Bill 487, please?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is the bill that prohibits the offers of automatic renewal or continuous service arrangements unless there is disclosure provided. The committee earlier adopted the -A7 amendment and the A9 amendment. The A9 eliminated the emergency clause, and the A7 amendment allows the disclosure requirements to be fulfilled when the person receives their initial invoice. There are no revenue impacts or no fiscal impacts on the amendments.
And we have received those fiscal impact
right.
statements
mm-hmm.
saying there are none. Thank you very much. Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 487 to the floor, but do pass amended recommendation. That's Amendments 7 and 9.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 487 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to declare a potential conflict of interest.
And would you like to state what that is?
Sure. I own an advertising agency, and this has to deal with direct response advertising. I'd also like to speak to it very briefly.
Certainly.
I'm going to be a no on this. My objection to this is that the FTC already provides for most of this, probably not as elaborate, but they have their five principles, which directly target direct response online advertising, deals with the size, color, and location where consumers are likely to see a disclosure, deals with placement of buttons, deals with the affirmative consent to the offer. The bill's well-intentioned, but it's already being handled by the federal government, and that's where it should be.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Any other discussion? And certainly I appreciate Representative Sheehan's point of view on that. I slightly disagree with it, though, thinking that the state does need to have some enforcement in this arena and some sort of authority to act on these issues. So I'll be supporting the bill going forward. And we have the motion on the dais here. Tamara, could you give us a vote, please?
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative
Clem. Aye.
Representative Conger.
Excused.
Representative
Matthews. Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
No.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnett.
Yes.
Co-Chair Holby.
Aye. Senate Bill 487.
That's your font.
Having received or acquired votes. Is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Oh, that's how you do it.
Carrier on this bill? Thank you, Representative Matthews. Appreciate it. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 487. With that, I'll open a possible work session on Senate Bill 491.
Oh, 491, I'm sorry. Let me get my script out here.
Jan, could you remind us what Senate Bill 491 entails?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, as committee members, Senate Bill 491 is a bill that modifies requirements for the notice of foreclosure and termination of tenancy to tenants of residential dwellings that are in foreclosure.
Whatever's in.
Committee has heard the bill before and has adopted the A5 amendment earlier. It deletes language inadvertently added during drafting. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 491 to the floor, but do pass the amended recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 491 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Not seeing any discussion. Tamara, would you give us a vote, please?
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Yes.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Hovey. Aye. Senate Bill 491, having received required votes, is passed to the floor. And I will close this, the work session on Senate Bill 491. Carrier on this bill on dealing with foreclosure.
Representative Congress, I do.
Representative Conger?
Yes, although there's a high risk it'll fail if I carry.
Thank you. And with that, we'll stand at ease for just a minute. With this, I would like to reconvene the House Committee on General Government, Consumer Protection, and Representative Wisnett. I'd like to entertain a motion to suspend the rules for the purposes of allowing Representative Conger to vote on Senate Bill 382 and Senate Bill 487.
Yeah.
Sure. I concur.
Representative Wisnett has moved to suspend the rules for the purposes of allowing Representative Conger to vote on Senate Bill 382 and Senate Bill 487. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the rules are suspended. With that, I'll open a possible work session on Senate Bill 382. Representative Conger, how would you vote on Senate Bill 382?
Aye.
That Representative Conger votes aye. Let the record reflect that. I'll close a possible work session on Senate Bill 382. Open a possible work session on Senate Bill 487 for the purpose of allowing Representative Conger to vote on Senate Bill 487. Representative Conger, how do you vote?
Aye.
Let the record show Representative Conger votes aye on Senate Bill 487. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 487. And
you sent me another note. Yeah, it's kind of weird.
With that, I'll stand at ease for one more minute. Thank you. I'd like to reopen the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 586. Jan, can you give us a brief description on Senate Bill 586?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the committee has not heard this bill before. It is a bill that modifies a requirement that public improvement contracts for construction or major renovation of public buildings will spend 1.5% of the contract price on solar energy. Change that to allow 1.5% to be spent on green energy technology. And it applies to public improvement contracts advertised or solicited on or after the effective date. And you have before you an A6 amendment that is submitted by Representative Holby. It states the policy of the state of Oregon regarding the production of electricity used in public buildings. It redefines green energy technology to exclude wind, hydroelectric, biomass, and conservation. And it specifies that solar systems are to be on-site and used for solar electricity generation, solar thermal generation, or passive solar energy generation. And it specifies that on-site geothermal systems include those that generate electricity or directly use geothermal energy. It utilizes on-site geothermal resources of 100 degrees Fahrenheit or greater.
Thank you. I know we have Lynn Montgomery here, and I don't to testify. Jeff Bissonette, were you able to testify on this bill? Or yes or no?
I can if you like.
Well, we'll let Glenn, he's the only one that signed up, so. A little bit odd. Good morning.
Good morning, Coach Harrell.
If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Co-Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. I'm here to speak in opposition of the Senate Bill 586 for several reasons. The original intent of the legislation to enact a budget provision of 1.5% for solar was just that. It was meant to be part of a coordinated strategy by the state of Oregon to promote solar energy, whether it be photovoltaic, solar thermal, or passive solar, on public buildings. I say that because we had a coordinated strategy both from an economic development standpoint, attracting solar manufacturers here in Oregon, but also from a deployment standpoint, using the solar resource that we've got available across the state for public buildings. So the intent of the legislation was to do just that, promote solar energy and try to create a robust industry in Oregon. We're on our way. We've got a toehold. But that legislation only went into effect a few years ago, and it really hasn't had a chance to be implemented. We've not seen it through. We've only had a few public buildings that have been affected by this legislation, some of which have requested waivers. And so we are still trying to get this program off the ground. By introducing additional technologies, we may be introducing confusion. The solar energy resources available across the state. Some of these other technologies, geothermal being one, is a regional resource. It's available some places, not others. And I think by adding those other green technologies, we introduce some confusion and we don't allow the initial intent of the legislation to be implemented as it was proposed. So That's my basic suggestion. I'm not privy to the recent amendments. I was not involved. As a stakeholder, it would have been nice. I would really like to be involved in these conversations on anything that's going to affect the industry. I'm not privy to the most recent amendments, but it would certainly be something that I would like to have a stake in as we move forward. Those are my basic comments. I've provided some written testimony to back that up, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have at this time.
Questions of Mr. Montgomery?
Yeah, who's like?
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, in its current form and where we stand now in history, who likes this bill?
Co-Chair Holby. Representative Smith, members of the committee, I'm not sure. I haven't spoken to anybody who's actually advocating for this bill, okay. At least from the industry.
Okay.
Thank you. And maybe we could, Jeff, if you wouldn't mind coming up, he's got a little more background perhaps on this bill. And sorry to drag you up here in public hearing, but you need to have a little broader conversation. So if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette. I'm here representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, which was one of the main proponents behind the original bill, whose number I'm blanking on at the moment, but I believe is 2007. And the intent was to, as we were looking at larger energy policies and looking at where renewables and different types of renewables were fitting in with efficiency, et cetera, and this was also the same session that we were looking at the renewable portfolio standard, there were some things that were done specifically with solar in other states that we didn't think were particularly good policy for the state of Oregon for solar. And so we tried to do a few other things to help solar out, to make sure that we had the support of the solar industry for the renewable portfolio standard, to make sure that we continued to build on Oregon's then growing, still growing role for the solar industry, particularly in manufacturing. And this bill was a part of that effort. It was, good politics, but it was also good policy as well. And so I think that with this bill, and I'm just reading the A6 amendments, and the way I read them is to provide a little bit more clarity in terms of where, where the requirement for the 1.5% lies for public buildings, defining green technologies, particularly on on-site, because we have a lot of large-scale energy sources being driven by the RPS, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, and as we look at technologies like solar and like some other small-scale technologies, those are really, those are pushing on-site type of applications where the resource itself may be a little bit more expensive, but because you are dealing with peak resources, because you are dealing with resources that do not require as much in distribution and transmission costs, it starts to balance out and it starts to create a more balanced electricity portfolio for utility ratepayers. I note here that there is a definition for on-site geothermal electricity generation. I agree with Mr. Montgomery that has limited application in various parts of the state, but to the extent that it's available, again, really focusing on the on-site nature, I think is a good attempt at trying to maintain the original policy that we were trying to balance out again with the RPS and moving a bunch of different energy policy pieces into place. I'd say that the Dash A6 kind of does start to pursue that that original intention as I read it. And so, again, I'm here to give some background. I'm happy to answer questions from the very quick and very high overview I just gave.
Thanks. I had one question for you. I appreciate that because I've been following this bill a little bit closely the last week, trying to come to grips with what it was doing to the original and things. The original bill also included conservation as being something that would qualify for the 1.5%, and that one was sort of confusing to me because conservation is addressed in other programs and is part of building codes as well when you're building a building. And so I was trying to weigh how that actually fits in with, renewable energy generation to start with, other than it reduced the need, I guess.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, when you're talking about the original bill, you're talking about
right.
The original version of 586, not the original bill that was passed in 2007.
Correct.
Yes. In the original bill that passed in 2007, about the only thing we talked about in terms of efficiency there is for passive solar. A building could include passive solar as long as it could demonstrate that it could achieve a 20% reduction in energy usage. And so that's more than just saying putting a window and saying, oh, I have passive solar. I've completed the requirement. You had to sort of have a threshold of certain energy savings that can be achieved through passive solar technology and application. In terms of kind of the larger question of energy efficiency and renewables, in the state, we have tended to separate efficiency and renewables policy for the public purpose charge, which was established back in 1999 to take ratepayer funds to accomplish certain utility objectives like reducing energy usage, like building small-scale energy, renewable energy technologies. There were separate designations and separate percentages outlined, so this much is going to energy efficiency. Much more, a very high amount going to energy efficiency, and this amount, a much smaller number going to renewables. If you look at the application in public buildings, there was another bill passed. It was attempted in 2007, was not passed until 2008, requiring that state-owned buildings achieve a 20% reduction in energy usage by, 2020. And so, again, separating renewables and efficiency, because really the two don't mix very well. We see a policy example up in Washington State where that state's renewable portfolio standard allows energy efficiency to meet some renewables requirements, and you're really talking apples and oranges. It's hard to replace energy usage with clean energy generation, and so we've tried to do both in this state, but follow parallel paths, making sure that we set aside resources for energy efficiency and also set aside resources for renewables, and so making sure that we achieve both policy objectives but not trying to mix and match the same. And so to the extent that bills try to do that, we tend to urge caution around that and say, you're either pursuing energy efficiency or you're pursuing renewables policy. We try to keep them coordinated, but not to do that in the same bill with the same requirements.
Thank you. I appreciate that background. I think it's good. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Montgomery, how old is the solar energy business?
Chair Holby, Representative Wisnett, members of the committee, are you asking specifically how old the industry is in Oregon?
Yes. No, within the nation.
Within the nation. I'm not sure off the top of my head I could give you that answer.
20 years, 30 years?
Greater than that.
Thank you. Follow-up. Representative Hovey and myself have very interested in this industry because he produces the panels and we put them in Central Oregon where we have sun. I would like to represent Congress, and I would like to have a big solar panel. My concern is I'm a child of the textile industry, and would you think that this is protectionism and government subsidies to the solar energy, what we're doing here?
Chair Holby, Representative Wisnett, I think there is a place for public policy and investment to help provide incentives for a variety of purposes. And renewable energy has clearly been one of those that we have identified, and specifically solar energy has been one that we have not only identified, we've begun to implement policies that have proven very successful. But admittedly, it's only been these last few years that we've actually begun to see the fruits of that labor. And my hope is that we continue to allow it to mature, because we're still not at a point where that is mature. We haven't seen broad-scale implementation. We've seen it in various areas. This is an opportunity with regard to distributed generation where we can see it broadly applied.
Thank you, but follow up, Mr. Chair.
But
what we're doing here, if we're not allowing geothermal, or we're not doing this, that's protectionism. Would you not agree?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wisnant, I don't see it as protectionism, and I certainly don't oppose the other renewable technologies. What I see it as is perhaps diluting a strategy that we've got in place, a very focused strategy and coordinated effort to work to promote one specific technology. That doesn't mean we can't look to have strategic efforts to promote the others. I'm trying to avoid the commingling at this point very early on in the stage, because we really haven't allowed this first strategy to be fully implemented.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Again,
Glenn, I mean, I'm for solar energy, but you just said it's over 30-year industry. It's probably 50-year industry. So I have problems with that. I think, Mr. Chair, also, I have not worked with Senator Wisnant. This bill came forth because Klamath OIT, if I'm not mistaken, the chair knows very well, co-chair knows very well, too, that the OIT has geothermal energy, and OIT was willing to build buildings. We also have our committee administrator was contacted by the Department of Corrections. They're also using geothermal in a couple of their facilities, or they plan to at Junction City. Is this correct?
And yes.
They ask it the bill be made retroactive. I don't think we're going to go there yet. But Mr. Chair, so I guess a question to Jeff would also be, I think what the CUB is interested in is providing the most efficient cost and service to the customers, and so I think that anywhere we can do that, we should be doing that. Representative Conger and I had a bill that I guess we didn't have to proceed with because, believe it or not, in Central Oregon, the community college is located where it gets very little solar. On the side of a hill, the wrong side of the hill, for the afternoon sun. But Mr. Chair Hovey pointed out to me, we were trying to get that 1.5 or 15%, whatever, 1.5 transferred to another building to combine. But we do have that, I guess, in statute now. So, again, I'm a supporter of solar power. I just think that I want to be careful. We're not getting into protectionism and government subsidy for a certain industry that's already developed. My background is research and development in the military, and I realize that you fail a lot in early research and development, but this industry is pretty well stable at this point. So thank you for your testimony.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll just point out a couple key concerns I have is that you weren't contacted in this bill, and I think you should have had some input in how it was crafted and how it was drafted. In the amendments, apparently, you're not aware of those either and don't have those dash sixes that we referred to earlier. I think for me, the concern I have is, again, we met and I appreciate your time in meeting. Gresham has done a lot of work to attract Selexant, which is going to come in and give, 100 jobs initially to the area. Hopefully, 170 when they're done. It's going to bring much needed, economical gain to our area. And I'm sure that part of the strategy was attracting them with some of the current situation, the statutes that we have in place. If we're going to change those things, I certainly think that folks in the industry should be involved. And so for me, if it was a desire of the chair to move forward, I would be opposed until I could further clarify just what this means to Selexant and what their decisions were coming to Gresham. But I appreciate your testimony and your time.
Thank you.
I
appreciate that, Representative Matthews. Going back, this bill was also looked at very favorably by Solar World as they were trying to decide on whether to move to Oregon or not, and looking for policies in Oregon that reflected some interest in solar. And Representative Wisnant brings up an interesting point, though, looking at the broader spectrum of renewable energies, and should we be availing this particular statute to broaden out to other renewables. And that brings to mind, as I've sort of reviewed some of the things that have happened with the Betsy over time, has been relatively heavily used by some renewable industries, but not others. And does Does the Betsy get much use in the world of solar energy? Or does the solar energy use the Betsy very often?
Chair Holby, solar is very dependent on the Betsy, even more so with regard to commercial projects, which would be, as an example, these public projects. We've had tremendous obstacles trying to implement solar energy on public buildings. Most recently, it's regarding a property tax exemption that has been on the books for many, many years for alternative energy devices. But about a year ago, the Department of Revenue shifted its interpretation as to what types of properties could enjoy that exemption. And it turns out that any project that involves a third-party investor, which most public projects do, we've been using the Betsy pass-through, if you're familiar with that mechanism, would fall into the latter category where the Department of Revenue says that is a taxable piece of property. So we have a number of projects currently that have been stalled over the last year because investors are waiting to see if that property tax exemption is going to be clarified and extended, if the sunset's going to be extended from next year. And that's millions of dollars on the table waiting to be spent in Pendleton, in Bend, in Klamath Falls, in Lincoln City, in Portland, that are not moving forward. So we're running up against many obstacles, and this is yet another problem for us in terms of diluting the effect of the programs that are supporting solar.
And thank you. That's what I understood, that the Betsy was, there were some obstacles with solar around the Betsy. Jeff, do you?
Yeah, just a quick general comment. I think that when we look at energy policy, we need to understand there's not, you know, a silver bullet that, you know, gets us, you know, where we want to go in any particular industry or in kind of cleaning up our energy and generation sources. So I testified that I was testifying on behalf of the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, which is a statewide collaboration of consumer groups, environmental organizations, human service agencies, faith groups, labor groups, clean energy businesses. Representative Wisnett noted that I also represent the Citizens Utility Board, which represents residential utility ratepayers, which is a founding member of the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition. And so, you know, you just heard a big list of types of groups, and so there's a lot of interest there to balance out. And from a ratepayer perspective in particular, we want to push renewable industries, we want to push renewable technologies and cleaner generation sources, but not at all costs. And so we want, both the coalition in general and CUB in particular supported the original 1.5% for solar because it's saying we want to put this amount of money and support an industry where it's not quite cost effective, but it's getting very close to cost effective. And as you look at, again, on-site technology to balance out your portfolio, there aren't that many on-site technologies aside from solar. There's some on-site wind, but you're not generating a lot, and it's not often cost-effective. In different regions, you can look at geothermal, but at that point, say we're trying to establish a broader policy, if that's the desire of the legislature to help public buildings, you know, say, you know, on the OIT campus where it might make sense. That's, you know, a decent policy discussion, a decent policy debate, and ultimately maybe a decent policy decision to have. I'll also note that on the larger renewable energy standard policy that we had, we have a 4% cost cap. And so if utilities rates are going to be driven above 4%, what they otherwise would be, in complying with the law, they can stop at that level and still be in compliance with the law. I'll note that that's the only generation source that has that sort of cost protection. If there was a natural gas plant or something like that that would cost more than that, they could still build that, and that would have the effect on rates that it would have. And so I think that, again, we are trying to have a balanced policy. We're trying to make sure that Oregon maintains its leadership role. There is an economic benefit to that, but from the perspective of ratepayers, we want to have fair, just, and reasonable rates. And we believe that we can do both. You can make the investments at an appropriate level still protect consumers and protect consumers' pocketbooks.
Thank you. I appreciate that testimony. I like Representative Matthews. I'm a little wary of moving forward with this without a perhaps a little bit broader discussion. I'm hopeful that if we don't move this bill forward, that maybe there will be some opportunity to have the solar industry's input into this concept, because I think there's actually a good argument for expanding this, especially to geothermal, where I think there's some great opportunities, and I'd be very willing to entertain this again in February if we could come together and have a broader conversation. It was a little dismaying to move something forward over the top of the solar industry when it potentially impacts them and not having them able to weigh in on this subject matter up until now. So with that, I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 586 and stand at ease for just a moment. When we needed to have votes and
Thursday's meeting.
Jan, we have a meeting scheduled on Thursday where we've invited some agencies in to come in and talk to us about general government and consumer protection as to what they see in the future in terms of legislation that would be helpful to the governments and consumers. So I'm hopeful that you'll be able to attend to help us take in their comments, as Representative Wisnett and I are working on an interim plan of what issues and items we'll be discussing during the interim ahead of
committee bills.
Ahead of February, and you know, we will have some committee bills. I think tentatively, the rumor is that we'll have 5 committee bills. I believe that's also subject to change until we actually get them. I'm not sure, but so that if you want to have any input, I appreciate you coming, listening, and so that we as a committee can then have some discussions about where we think the interest of this committee should lie for February. So with that, thank you very much, and I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.